originating from our Jimmy John's of Lexington studios. This is Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka on the Horse Racing Radio Network. An intimate, in-depth discussion with the best jockeys in thoroughbred racing.
25-year-old Mario Gutierrez, who took Derby 1:38.
Digging down for the final 16th under Victor Espinosa.
Joe Calamo in the ride of his life, in the race of his life.
Gary Stevens, 3 Preaknesses.
A brilliant ride by Calvin Burrell.
Up the inside under Johnny Velasquez to take it.
Shanghai Bobby and Rosina Pradnik come again to beat. He's had enough.
Raji Barrage aboard, crushing the field here.
Perfectly ridden by Javier Castellano. A scintillating performance under Rafael Bejarano.
Now, here's Christina McManigal.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. I'm your host, retired jockey Christina McManigal, and I'm joining you tonight from our Jimmy John's of Lexington, Kentucky studio. I'd like to thank everyone listening tonight on Sirius 219, XM 201, and also to those of you tuning in to our website at horseracingradio.net. So a portion of the proceeds from this show go to the Permanently Disabled Jockeys Fund. The PDJF provides financial assistance to riders who have suffered devastating on-track injuries. If you're able to help, please visit their website at www.pdjf.org. So our guest tonight, he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2009. He was a recipient of both the George Wolfe Memorial Jockey Award and the Mike Venezia Award. He's won over 217 graded stakes winners, including the Belmont Stakes twice, first in 1980 with Temperance Hill, and again in 1985 with Creme Fraiche. He also won the Travers 3 times, the Kentucky Oaks, the Arlington Million, and was aboard for Secretariat's final race in the Canadian International. With 4,398 wins and over $105 million in earnings, it's a pleasure to introduce jockey Eddie Maple. Eddie, welcome to the show.
Okay, Christine, I'm glad to be here. Let's see what we can tell these people.
Love it, Eddie. Like I said, I told you on the phone, we've had numerous requests to hear your story here on the show, and you're actually joining us tonight from South Carolina.
Yes, indeed. Beautiful South Carolina. It's a little gloomy here today, but as a rule, it's a pretty nice place to live.
And tell us what you're doing these days.
My wife Kate and I took over the equestrian center at Rose Hill Plantation, which is in Bluffton, South Carolina, in 2006. And we had 4 horses boarding here in a 35-stall barn, and now we've got 35 horses in our barn. And a small but elite waiting list. So we're having quite a bit of fun, but at the same time, there's some agita involved. But this is what we've been doing, and it's gotten a little bit easier. Just the fact that we've settled in and people got to know us, and we're pretty used to the area and where we can manufacture more borders if we need it. But right now, it's a pretty good situation for us, and we live right here in Rose Hill, and it's things are going well.
I'm sure you keep busy, Eddie, as we all know. Caring for horses, that's a 24/7, 365-day job. And sure, you're very busy, especially with the number of horses you mentioned that are boarding there at your facility. But do you ride for pleasure anymore?
Oh, yeah. I still ride. I've got a rescue horse that I'm trying to make into a little bit of a jumper. And he takes up quite a bit of my time. But Kate and I kind of... we switch off on, she's got a 29-year-old thoroughbred mare that we bred, and she still does a little bit of dressage. And we keep her fine-tuned. And I'm also available to any of our boarders that go out of town for for any of the holidays that I should be going out of town for, but I'm not because I'm boarding other people's horses. And so I ride usually 3 or 4 times a week.
How old are you, Eddie?
Why don't you look in the racing manual?
Well, I want to hear it from yourself.
Yeah, I'm 70.
70 years old.
70 years old.
You're years young, as I like to say.
Well, it's some days I feel 70 years young, and some days I feel 70 years old, but more young than old. So
well, that's good.
We keep on chugging along.
Do you miss riding races?
No. I enjoy, really, really enjoy watching the races. And these guys that are the jockeys that are riding today, it's such a pleasure to watch them. You know, they just make it look so easy. And it is a pleasure to watch that. And I must honestly say that I do not miss it. I could go probably and ride a couple of races as long as everybody was as old as I was. But it was a fun time for those 30-odd years, but we'll let somebody else handle it now.
You mentioned that they make it look easy these days, but honestly, Eddie, watching you ride, always been a huge fan. You made it look easy, if you ask me. But let's start with talking about how you got involved in the sport of kings. And so you started riding in Ohio and West Virginia. Did you grow up in a racing family?
No. You talk about as far away as you could possibly get from a racing career. It was a small town in Ohio. When I say small, I mean small, 500 people. But there was one thoroughbred farm, and it was awful inviting with those mares and the foals hanging around in the summertime. And I just went down and asked the guy if he needed some extra help, and he put me to work. And unbeknownst to me, you know, he was in the business of making jockeys as well as breeding his own Ohio breds and racing them. And that I was 12 years old, so things just kind of went on from there.
What was his name?
His name was George Stribling.
George Stribling, and he got you started, Eddie, and when you first went to work at the farm, what did you start out doing?
They were away racing, and there was a couple of other hired hands there, and I was mucking. Oh, back at that time of year, it was they had a run-in shed, so I was up to my knees and mucking that out and keeping halfway decent for the mares and the foals that had been born that spring, the foals. And probably had a handful of turnouts, you know, from the track that needed a little R&R. But that was basically, I was doing that and making hay and trying to keep, you know, the woodchucks under control one way or the other. And it was just a way to spend the summer. There were 8 children in our family, and I didn't feel like I was getting pushed out or anything, but, you know, it was a good change for me. I got picked up for church, and the school bus picked me up for school. So it was just a little ways from my home, but it was still a very exciting summer for me, and I looked forward to whatever came next.
When did you actually start getting on the back of horses?
Probably 13. It wasn't too long after that first summer, but I actually went to school there in the winter. I pretended like I was breaking yearlings, but I really wasn't. But I did become familiar with a Old George stable pony, and just my balance and everything that he had me starting out on, and probably got on my first thoroughbred the next year at 14, and that was breaking yearlings, and then off to the track I went. Too young, but who's looking?
You mentioned George helped you work on your balance. What do you mean by that, and how did he do that?
Well, first of all, just sitting on a horse's back, you know, with your stirrups, they weren't up high naturally, but you know, anybody that just walks into a barn and sees that there's a pony there that can ride, you know, they look kind of crappy first time or two because you know, it's different than walking or running or standing around, and it's possible to fall off of a standing still horse just because your legs are spread apart, and if you do happen to tilt one way or the other, there's a lot to overcome in the horse world.
Did you find it came natural to you?
No, I think probably a little bit, but not. I think probably early on it did. But instead of things getting easier, it got harder. It was probably because I was tackling more things, you know, as I got more experience. He was putting me on, you know, tougher horses when I was galloping. You know, we broke the babies in the wintertime in Ohio. That wasn't pretty as far as the weather goes, but it, you know, it's like any other job. The more experience you get, in this case, it was my contract holder and this man that he made my work a little bit harder, which was okay, I guess, in the long run. But I can remember just getting, I was thinking that I wasn't going to make it doing this for a living. And that's probably what he wanted to find out too. So we just kind of kept whittling away and practicing and trying to get stronger. And that was probably one of the big things. I was awful small. I think when I rode my first race, I weighed 90 pounds, and I was at 17. So you can imagine at 14 how tiny I was. But it turned, you know, that's a godsend in the jockeys, in the jockey world, being small when you're young and probably not a lot of muscle, but it came along gradually.
Yeah, breaking those yearlings, that'll teach you real quick to stay on the back of one. But the best way to learn, really, you learn pretty quickly doing that. And George, sounds like he was pretty tough on you, Eddie, but worked out anyway, worked out well for you. At that time, when you're having these doubts where you're not even sure if you're going to make it, what was the alternative for you in the long range? What other kind of occupation did you ever think about doing?
Well, as you well know, there's plenty of things you can do on the track. I mean, the jockey thing really hadn't sunken in yet. But, you know, there were people that gallop horses for a living, not so much freelance back in those days. But, you know, I could have probably just galloped horses for the guy, you know, and made a decent living. Certainly no comparison, but the racetrack, the first year I hit the racetrack, it was mind-boggling to me to see all the people that were there that made a living, and I turned out being, I mean, working my way through being an exercise rider, a hot walker, a groom. I mean, for the first 3 years until I started riding, even after I started riding, this guy had my contract, so I did all three of those. And if there was a horse that I couldn't was incapable of riding, after I started riding, I would be the groom. And many a times I did everything that a groom does. I did everything that a hot walker does. That was my bringing up. I did all those things that two or three different people do now, or even then. But there was nothing, if there was no standing around. I always had to have a water bucket or a wash bucket or some kind of bucket in my hand if I didn't have a shank or a saddle or a bridle. I had to be doing something. And that's just the way it was. That's the way, I don't think it's like that anymore, but that's the way I was brought up. And I think probably all that stuff made me a stronger guy, you know, carrying water buckets and wash buckets. And that's basically my routine.
So when did you know you were ready? Did George tell you? Did he say, okay, look, you're ready to ride a race? Or was that your idea?
No. Nobody's idea. I mean, my father at the time visiting George would say something like that, and George says, I have no idea.
Really?
When he'll be ready. And then it was sort of like, it was like all of a sudden, I had my 17th birthday was coming up, and I don't know if that had anything to do with it, but decided at Charlestown, West Virginia, on that cold November night, that was going to be my first race. So that's he probably told me 2 weeks before. And I don't think I probably slept a wink those 2 weeks. But and it was my 17th birthday, and at Charlestown, West Virginia, and it was very cold. But I rode my first race in gloves, which you were crazy if you didn't, even if you couldn't hold on. And so it was basically just a chance that he took. And I think in the next month I probably only rode two more races, and then we went back to the farm. So he wasn't in any hurry to get me started. I think he was waiting on a better time of year for me to break my maiden and have my apprenticeship starting. And so, yeah, actually I did go to Waterford Park, which is now what is Waterford called now?
Waterford Park, is that in Ohio?
No, that's the track. They have the casinos there.
Mountaineer.
Mountaineer.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was Waterford Park. You know, the $2,000 races and stuff like that. I mean, he had a pretty good bunch of horses, so they were usually pretty well placed. But I did win my first race there and got disqualified, and then that was really it. He chewed me out and took me back to the farm for another month. So that was the first couple months of my racing life, my jockey life.
Got disqualified your first winner. That's, I can't imagine the grief you received from him, as you mentioned. But what happened in the race?
Well, God, there was a one valet I know that I used to go when I went to Keeneland and Churchill to ride during my racing career, that it was in that race. And I had five of them stacked up on the inside fence. I had come from last, and as I'm going by all the leaders, I hit my horse right-handed, and he just got away from me and just stacked them all up. Nobody fell, and I ended up getting five days. And so, you know, I was lucky that, you know, nobody got hurt, so that probably would have scarred me for life. But then Gus Theodosius was the jockey that was a valet in Kentucky. He used to tell everybody that story. Anyways.
You never lived that down.
I ride the Kentucky Derby, and he's telling the press people that this jock stood me on my head, which I didn't do, but it was close.
Jockey Eddie Maple joining me tonight on Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Eddie, you said you were one of eight children. And didn't your younger brother ride as well?
I did have a younger brother. I had two of them that ended up riding some races. Sam was 5 years younger than me, maybe four, and he was a very, very, very good rider. He's deceased. He died of cancer at age 44. Mm. He rode in Kentucky and Nebraska circuit and New Orleans and won a lot of big races, won the Travers, came to Saratoga and won the Travers and on a horse called Jatsky, I think it was his name, out of Kentucky. And my younger brother, Mark, who always was the biggest one in the family, he ended up squeezing about a year and a half out of riding until he just got way too big. But I guess there was a little bit of race riding in the whole family. My aunt sent me a picture of my father on his way to school, and he was standing up on this paint pony with no shoes on and standing right straight up in the air. So I guess the jockey genes go all the way back to him.
What did your mother think when three of her children end up riding races?
Well, my mom died at 45. And so she saw me ride, and I think she saw Sam ride a couple. No, she didn't. No, she didn't. Because I was riding it in Maryland with the bug, and I had to come home because she was sick and she died. Mm. So she didn't see Sam or she didn't see Mark. So I was the only one, and she had no idea what was going on. It was as close as she could come to thinking that this was something that I really enjoyed doing. I don't think she was real happy about it because of all the things that could happen to a guy sitting on a horse going that fast with no seatbelt or anything. So, but she tolerated it for a year and a half, I guess. And then I always wonder if I had anything to do with her getting sick, but I never believed that. Mm. And then it was just my father coming to the races once in a while. He saw a couple derbies that I was in, and one derby Sam and I were both in. They drove down from Ohio for that. But he didn't do much traveling. He was busy with the family and everything. So he did make the trip to Kentucky. But that's the story with our family. And it was a pleasure to ride with Sam, the opportunities that we had together. And he came to New York to ride a few times, and we caught up on everything.
Were you extra competitive with your brother?
No. No, if anything, it was the other way around. I think I was always on the lookout for him, you know, in a good way. You know, when we were riding in those kind of races, I had too much respect for him. And being my brother, I figured, well, I'm already halfway up the heap. Let's see if we can give him a little boost.
I love it. Well, let's talk about how you got to New York. We got to talk about your very first winner. I believe that happened at Charlestown. And talk about the bull ring. And I've ridden at Charlestown, and you have to have guts to go there, definitely. And you have to be quick out of the gate. So describe your first winner, Eddie.
Well, actually, you probably read that. And it kind of got mixed up with probably my first ride. But my first winner was at Ascot Park, which was worse than Charlestown. It was in Akron, Ohio. And it was my very first horse back after my suspension at Waterford Park. And then my boss came, and it was a first-time starter called Swami going at 4.5 furlongs. and there was only one turn, 4.5 furlongs, but it was a hairpin. And it was, that's about all I remember. His name was Swami, and I think my coach ran him for 5,000 claimant, and he was probably worth 50,000. But he won easy, and then at Ascot Park, I ended up having a very good meet there. I did have a terrible fall just before the end of the meet, and didn't break anything except I was unconscious for a short amount of time. But and then we moved on from there. So the first race, you just heard about that. It took a he took a base on balls with that running that horse for that kind of money. But he was, turned out to be a very nice horse and got claimed and went to Chicago and won some decent allowance races on the grass. So that just kind of tells you what kind of horse he was. But he broke my maiden.
In style, Eddie, I like it. did the other jocks, I know these days they initiate you. They throw water and eggs and baby powder, God knows what else. Did they do that when you won your first race?
They certainly did. They did just about everything you could possibly do to a guy. And I was just turned 17, so I wasn't in any shape to be able to fight any of those guys off that were around there that were pulling 5 or 6 pounds a day to ride. But, yeah, I got initiated, and I felt like one of the guys for about an hour. I realized I wasn't. I was still a green apprentice.
I love it, Eddie. And during, obviously, you were riding for George at the time, and you mentioned the contract you had with him. How long did that contract last?
I had a 3-year contract, but I really rode steady for him for 2 years. And then I had an opportunity to hook up with Marion H. Vanberg, who was Jack Vanberg's father. Jack trained Ali Sheba and so many good horses, and his father, he had like 50 horses at Cleveland, and then he went on to Detroit. And George let me go with him, and we just kind of tore up the contract. I made that Ohio circuit 2 years, Ohio, Detroit, well, a year and a half back. And then he wasn't going to Detroit that year because he didn't have enough horses to get stalls. So he let me go with Mr. Vanberg, who had about 50 horses, and he made me leading rider, and he was leading trainer. So it kind of gave me a jump start, you know, if I wanted to stick around there. But I think in the fall of, you know, in the spring of 67, now my mom died in 66. No, she died in the spring of 67, and then I went back to Maryland. I didn't go back to Detroit. I went to Maryland.
Well, Eddie, we have to take a quick commercial break. Folks, stay with us. You are listening to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Tito Beveridge, founder and master distiller of Tito's Handmade Vodka, America's original craft vodka. I believe in the craft process of distilling in batches using old-fashioned pot stills, and that's the way we still make Tito's Handmade Vodka today. We even won the World Spirits Competition, double gold, unanimous judge's choice. Tito's Handmade Vodka is made from 100% corn, so it's naturally gluten-free. For recipes, videos, and more, visit titosvodka.com. 80 proof Tito's Handmade Vodka, 5th Generation Inc., distilled and bottled in Austin, Texas.
Hi, I'm John Velasquez.
And I'm Julian Lepau. Every jockey knows and accepts the risk of a sport every time they get a leg up on the horse.
Although catastrophic on-track accidents are rare, when they do happen, the lives of the jockeys and their family change forever.
It's up to all of us in racing to support these men and women.
That's why we support the Permanent Disabled Jockey Fund. Since its founding in 2006, the PDJF has disbursed over $8 million to over 75 permanently disabled jockeys.
Over 90 cents out of every dollar donated goes directly to these brave men and women.
They use the monthly stipend to pay bills, hire caretakers, and many other things that make living with a permanent disability just a bit easier.
This is Mike Penna of HRRN. Did you know that the PDJF has no permanent guaranteed funding mechanism and relies entirely on donations from people like you? Please visit the PDJF website at pdjf.org to learn how you can help.
Hi, I'm Ron Turcotte. I support the PDJF. I hope you will too. And I thank you.
You're listening to Jock Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka.
On the outside now, it's Temperance Hill with Codex. Those four now vying for the lead. Rock Hill Native on the rail has the lead by a neck. Genuine Risk on the outside, moving on the leader. Farther out is Temperance Hill. There into the stretch, three across the track. Genuine Risk between horses on the outside. Temperance Hill on the rail. It's Rock Hill Native. Those three continue to fight for the lead. Rock Hill Native on the rail has a narrow lead of ahead. Genuine Risk on the outside. Genuine Risk now takes the lead by a nose. Temperance Hill is right there. Temperance Hill now takes the lead. It's Temperance Hill, Arkansas Derby winner, taking the lead going off by two. The filly Genuine Risk is second and Rock Hill Native third. Temperance Hill in front.
Welcome back to Jock Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. I'm your host, Christina McManigal, and I am joined tonight by jockey Eddie Maple. Eddie, that was a replay of the 1980 Belmont, your victory aboard Temperance Hill. That was your first Belmont victory. And we're going to talk about that here in just a short time. I'm sure hearing the race replay brings back a lot of memories. But let's fast forward a little bit here, Eddie, and what made you decide to go to New York and what opportunities presented themselves?
Well, I tell you, it wasn't an easy decision, but it was one that was kind of dropped in my lap. I went on to New Jersey, Maryland, New Jersey, without an agent. I ended up hooking up with a Chicago-based trainer called Arnold Winnick, who had a very, very powerful stable, but he came to Atlantic City for the fall meet, and I dropped in there. And Howard Grant was there riding or getting ready to take the winner off. He was another jockey that George Trimbling brought out, a very, very good jockey. And he hooked me up with his agent. And Mr. Winnick took me to Florida. I was leading rider at the old Tropical Park. Went on to Hialeah and did fairly well, but all the New York riders were there. And it was tough. And then they went back to New York, and I stayed for Gulfstream, and Calumet Farm, Reggie Cornell, put me on a couple of horses. And darn if one of them isn't a horse called Eastern Fleet, who broke the track record going 7/8 a mile. I rode him back in the Florida Derby, and he won. And now he's like one of the favorites for the Kentucky Derby. This was in 1971. And So Calumet's going back to New York, and they asked me if I wanted to go. And I said, what, are you kidding? Anyways, that's how I got to New York.
Did you ride that horse in the Derby?
I rode him in the Derby. He and Son Ann, she rode it, run an entry, and they were favorite. This is my very first Kentucky Derby. I was 23 years old, and which was fine. And my horse was a good mile and an eighth horse, but not so good mile and a quarter, which was okay. And Son Ange was the same way, but we were trying to stretch out that Nazrul of Blood, you know, another eighth of a mile. And he stuck his nose in front at the eight pole and then got by three horses and he finished fourth. But it was a good effort and the people didn't fire me. Reggie didn't fire me. And we went back to New York. So now I'm in New York. Now all I have to do is stay there. You know, by that, I mean, do well enough. Kate and I just got married in December of 70. So we rented a house and things just kind of went along. I won 77 races that first year in New York, which was, I was tickled to death, and continued to ride for Calumet, and then their good horses started falling apart. But it seemed like every time I lost one of the Calumet horses, I was able to pick something up and do just as well. So in 1971, I was a very fortunate young fella from Ohio to make the connections that I made with T.J. Kelly. Lefty Nickerson was training for the powerful Elmendorf stable. I beat the boys in the Lexington Handicap on the grass. She was in with 109 pounds, and I didn't eat for like a week to ride her and do 109, and she beat the boys. And it was just things like that, just lucky, lucky, lucky.
Things started falling in place for you, Eddie, and including riding for a trainer named Joseph Canty, who had Cox's Ridge, who you had a lot of success with. Cox's Ridge. I mean, I'm looking at the list here. Numerous graded stakes victories, including the Oaklawn Handicap, just to name one of the many graded stakes races you won. The Metropolitan, the Grade One Metropolitan, with Cox's Ridge in 78. A nice, nice horse, but also the same connections, same trainer anyway, as Temperance Hill. So I'm assuming Cox's Ridge kind of got you in the barn.
Yeah, you know, their Lob Lolly stable jumped. They kind of came on the scene. Joe had been going to Arkansas with just a few horses that were friends of his, and then he ended up with this Lob Lolly stable of John Ed Anthony and his wife, and they just got, you know, just tremendous success with Joe. And so Joe, we started off with a few and ended up, you know, he was married to Charles C. Canty at the time. Kate and Charles became friends, and I was riding a couple of their, I rode a horse from Too Many Chiefs, who ran with an extension blinker and a big bear trap hit because he bolted out on the turns all the time. And I don't know, for some reason, I got along with him, and I won like four or five races on him. So no comparison to the Lob Lolly horses, but that kind of made Joe and I get a little bit, think we were lucky for each other. And then here comes Cox's Ridge and several other horses, and then Temperance Hill, and it was one very successful streak that we had.
Temperance Hill, you teamed up with Temperance Hill in the 1980 Jockey Club Gold Cup, the Travers, the Belmont, of course, the Oaklawn Handicap, the Razorback. A nice horse, Eddie, and tell us, what was his running style like? How was he like to deal with in a race?
Well, he behaved himself as a three-year-old. Every race, he just seemed to get a little bit smarter about what he was supposed to do. And not a lot of speed. Probably didn't want to make him do too much too early in the races. And it seemed like he, you know, really appreciated the chance to get his legs under him in those longer races. He didn't necessarily have to go that far, but he certainly shined, you know, at a mile, an eighth mile, a quarter mile and a half, the Jockey Club Gold Cup, Super Derby, mile and eighth at Louisiana Downs. So, you know, he ended up having everything that a good horse could possibly have during his three-year-old year. Like I say, if you just give him a chance, he produced for you.
Temperance Hill's trainer, Joe, gave you complete credit for your victory in the Belmont. He said that if you hadn't really pushed him earlier on, sensing a slower pace, said, you know, the best you would have had was fourth. And you sensed the slow pace, Eddie, so walk us through that race.
Well, I think the reason Joe said that, and he's right to a certain extent, but he did a hell of a training job with the mud caulks and stuff that day. But, he was just creeping up too easy. And those horses we're talking about, we've got the Derby winner in there. We've got the Preakness winner, plus Rock Hill Native, Genuine Risk, who won the Derby, Codex won the Preakness. And they all had tactical speed. But they were all eyeballing one another, and nobody was really wanting to set the pace. And as it turned out, when this horse started picking him up way at the 5.5, basically in a pretty off track also, which Temperance Hill liked, but so did everybody else, I think. But I just, there, I let him go. I didn't let him go, but it just kind of, by the time we got to the 3.5, it was like, oh, no, these guys they're playing with us back here. So I just kind of started actually from the 3A pole, and you know what you don't want to do at Belmont Park with that long stretch is move too soon. But it turned out that it wasn't too soon. It was the right thing to do rather than the wrong thing to do. And even though he caught up and ran with him for a 16th of a mile, he was the last 16th of a mile. He was definitely the best horse. So not taking anything away from anybody else, but they had everything their own way, and we still beat them.
What was that feeling like when you crossed the wire in front?
Oh, my God. I'd ridden in 3 or 4 derbies by that point, maybe a couple more, and a few Preaknesses. The Eastern Fleet came back and was second in that 1971 Preakness. And so I hadn't really had too much luck in those kind of races, the classics, I should say. But that was my first classic. I mean, I'd already ridden Secretariat and got him home, and that was the biggest thrill of my life. And then here's the second biggest thrill in my life is being able to win one of the classics.
Eddie Maple joining me tonight on Jog Talk, presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka, right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Eddie, you mentioned your ride aboard Secretariat in the Canadian International. You won that race by over 6 lengths. And when I read an interview you gave after the race, you talked about the massive stride of Secretariat, and you said that was the biggest thrill of your life. So let's talk about that for a minute.
Well, it turns out to be the horse of the century, and he made the Sports Illustrated Top Athletes edition. But, to take a jockey, regardless of how long you've ridden or how short a time you had ridden, it's still the fact that he was already had won the Triple Crown and a tearjerker, Belmont, drawing off and winning the way he did, and breaking 3 track records. It still was like, I'm sitting on this horse. And when we had a little interference down the backside and this horse took off, if I'd have had 6 reins, I wouldn't have been able to stop that motion. But it was just like changing, going from a Volkswagen to a Ferrari. He just jumped into the bridle, and off we went. We got a half a mile to go. I got to get him across the dirt. But, no, I'm not getting him across the dirt. We had already come across the dirt. But he just turned into the stretch with just you can even tell on the film, as crappy as it is, because of the darkness and the snow that was flying, that stride on him turning for home is just like something you just don't see. And I was able to experience it.
Who was the second nicest horse you rode during your career, one that came close to comparing with Secretariat?
Oh, my God. Nobody probably remembers this horse, but I rode a 2-year-old called Devil's Bag. Mm-hmm. And I don't even know what year. It was the same year as Swale. I ended up losing Swale when he won the Kentucky Derby. But anyhow, this horse is a two-year-old, and he didn't make it as a three-year-old. But he started to make it as a three-year-old, and that's where I got in trouble with my agent, and I got in trouble with picking the right horse. But he won those grade ones, and in three of those races, or two of them, he beat Swale. So I had the right horse. I just had the wrong time. My timing was off. But he was undefeated and a two-year-old champion. And I think that if things would have gone the other way for this horse, he probably would have been undefeated as a three-year-old because he could handle any kind of track. He had never run on the grass, but he was bred for it. His full sister, Gloria Song, was a champion in Canada and the United States. So I think that I would have to say Devil's Bag was probably the second best horse.
Yeah, you won the 83 Champagne, the 83 Laurel Futurity, and the 83 Cowden Stakes. So definitely a nice horse. But going back to Secretariat, I want to ask you, Ron Turcotte, of course, regular rider of Secretariat, had days at the time due to an incident in New York. And nowadays, you would just appeal those days. But back then, I guess that wasn't really something you could do. After the race, Eddie, did you call up Ron, and what did you say?
Well, he was in the winner's circle, and we chatted on the way back to the jockey's room, and then he went on. I think he went on upstairs, but it was just the way he laid it out for me. Lucian didn't even give me any instructions. Ronnie did, and the instructions were easy. Just get him to the gate as quiet as you can. He wasn't worried about the post position being on the outside. He said he may not break as quick as you'd like, but don't worry about that. He'll get himself in gear, which he did. And he said, don't worry about the dirt. He'll go across the dirt. If you get something in front of you, fine, which I did. I got that horse. I can't even think of the horse that was in front. Emilio Gomez rode him. And then for a mile and 5/8, it went so fast, and which those races usually do. But sitting on him, you know, kind of made it go faster. I wish I could slow it down in my mind and go back, but I can't because it went fast, and it'll never go any slower in my mind. I don't think. And like I say, Ronnie was instrumental in the whole thing, settling me down, you know, he wasn't in the paddock for the saddling, but he was in the winner's circle. And, you know, Ronnie was top flight person, top flight rider, Hall of Fame the whole way, and certainly knew his horse, and almost won two Triple Crowns the year before, almost won with Reba Ridge, if it hadn't been the mud. So we're talking about a guy that, you know, here's a jock that carries his own saddle around because he wanted every horse that he exercised in the morning, he wanted the best possible saddle he could have on that horse's back. You know, and I don't know of any other jockey that ever did that. He had a saddle with RT on it, and if you want him to work a horse, Elliot Birch, want him to work Shuvi or somebody, here, put my saddle on her, you know? And that's just the kind of guy he was. Very thorough, smart, very smart guy, very smart rider.
I think the world of Ron, and I encourage our listeners to go to the website, horseracingradio.net, because not too long ago, I had Ron Turcotte here on the show, and he gave a great interview as well, Eddie. You'll have to check that out.
I will.
Yeah. Let's talk about another very talented horse you rode, and you rode for the Connections, Woody Stevens, a name that's also said in the same breath as yours. You guys teamed up to so many great victories.
Unbelievable.
You won with Conquistador Cielo, of whom you scored one of three of your Metropolitan handicaps. And, of course, Creme Fraiche was Woody's fourth consecutive Belmont. That was the only time in history that's ever happened. I can't imagine, you know, the talent of Woody Stevens, the talented trainer he was. And what was it like to ride for him?
Well, you know, Woody was it was very intimidating when I first, I think I probably rode my first race for him in 76 maybe. But, you know, to ride for that guy, for me to be able to ride for him was, you know, I was a little sheepish, I guess, wanted to do my best, but knew that I probably had the horse, and if it did, everything would work out. And then we just kind of developed a friendship, and we made all those trips to the Meadowlands in the same limousine with our wives, and it just turned into a very workable relationship. You figure, well, people might get too close, but Woody and I didn't get too close. You know, I respected him, and he had respect for me as a jockey, and still had his plan on every race that he came into the paddock and I was riding his horse. He still had a plan. Wasn't a long plan. If we hadn't talked about it in the morning, even if we had, he wanted to make it like we hadn't. He wanted to refresh my memory. And it was just the horses that I won for him. Myself as a jockey, I've got tons of pictures at home and stuff, but I don't ever take that stuff out. That's over. But just to look back and the horses, I can't even remember some of their names, some of those good fillies that I rode for him. And we flew all over the country riding him, and we'd go and ride a good mare at Keeneland, and then we'd bring a private plane back and land at Teterboro, and I won the Young American on Swale that night. You know, it was just like when people just said, well, we can't beat him. But, you know, all things run out, but it was a good run. It was a good run. He's a hell of a trainer, for sure.
I can only imagine how special that Belmont victory was for you in 1985, given that in 1982 you had suffered a bad spill, cracked ribs, a punctured lung, and Conquistador Cielo, of course, won the Belmont, and you weren't able to ride, given your injuries. So 1985, you had your redemption. And tell us about the race.
Well, we finally got back. You're right. All that losing that horse, Conquistador Cielo, just kind of set the stage for what would happen in the next couple of years. But Creme Fraiche was an entry with Stephen's Odyssey. They weren't owned by the same person, but Woody trained them both. And Creme Fraiche, by a long shot, was supposed to be the long shot of the two. But it turns out that he wasn't that bad a horse, and he was up to the challenge. You know, he just turned out to be a good distance horse. And at the time, Mrs. Moran, who owned Creme Fraiche, well, I think she even rode him over some timber for a few years after he retired. But he was a gelding, and he was the first gelding, I think, to win the Belmont, if I'm not mistaken. I think he's the only gelding to win the Belmont. But that being said, he didn't have to be a stud, and he was able to hang around for a year or two longer because of that. And he just kept running as hard as he always ran. You know, he was a great racehorse.
Eddie, we only have a few minutes left here. Time is flying by. I joked during the break, we're going to have a 2-hour show with you here, Eddie, but we're not going to do that for real. But years later, you decide it's time to retire. And I have a list here. I think it's like 6 pages long, back to back, of all the greatest stakes you won. And the number is just astronomical. But the day you received the Mike Venezia Award, you announced your retirement. And why did you come to that decision?
Don't really know. I wasn't shooting for the Mike Venezia Award, but I was certainly honored to get it. And I'd been thinking about retiring not a whole lot of time before that, but it just looked like, you know, it was, my business was getting a little bit light. We had these kids coming up that were, you got Mike Smith, Gary Stevens, Bailey's in town. And that was in 98. They went on and wrote another 10. Well, Gary just retired. But it looked like things were going to get tougher before they got easier. And we had some things we wanted to do, Kate and I, and we wanted to move to the North Shore and spend some time on the water on Long Island before we made up our mind. And our boys were big and they were off to college and different things. But, and I was, I don't know how old I was. I guess I just turned 50. No, I hadn't turned 50. I was 49. You know, that's getting up there, you know.
Only about a minute left here, Eddie, and you were, of course, inducted into the Hall of Fame several years ago, and I know that came as a bit of a surprise. You'd been nominated several times, and finally it happened, so you will be remembered forever in the Hall of Fame and forever when anyone listens to the show as well, Eddie. So I can't thank you enough for joining us this evening. It has been such a pleasure. And, Eddie, I'm wishing you all the best. I'll have to come to South Carolina one of these days.
Well, you can Google Rose Hill Plantation and go to our barn. You can see our barn, and our, we've got 18 beautiful paddocks, and we've got 2 new arenas, a jumping arena and a dressage arena. And we've got a big, huge polo field, and we've got six miles of trails that my boarders can ride on, and it's we do have a lot of sand gnats, though.
Sounds like you keep busy, Eddie. Wishing you all the best. Thanks again.
All right, Christine.
Folks, you can check out this show and replays of all of our other shows on the website at horseracingradio.net. Now be sure to join me next Tuesday at 6 o'clock Eastern Time with another edition of Jock Talk presented by Tito's Handmade Vodka. For our producer, Lee Della Pina, I'm Christina McManigal, and thanks for listening.